record it, just put it here.
Okay, but it's not. There's something wrong with it.
Okay, Patricia Shaw is going to talk about sustaining dialect diversity across an endangered language diaspora. Okay, over to you.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to thank the Native Hawaiian people for the honor of being here on their traditional territory. Mahalo. And I would also like to express my very warm appreciation to the conference organizers for organizing such a wonderful, amazing conference for us to share and be here together with. So thank you. I'm going to be talking about sustaining dialect diversity in a revitalization program across a diaspora that's quite geographically spread. And first of all, I'd like to acknowledge with deep gratitude the fluent speakers and the cultural knowledge keepers who led their support to this project at the very outset. A number of these individuals, the first two on this slide, are no longer with us, and I'm profoundly honored to have known them and worked with them. Their initial commitment and leadership in partnering with this project has led to several other elders contributing their knowledge to our collaborative efforts for language documentation and revitalization. The other elders who we've worked with are listed here, along with where they're from. You'll see these places on the maps that we'll have a look at right now. Okay, so the Waukesha territory is represented by this part, the gold territory over here. The Kwakwala-speaking territory is the northern tip of Vancouver Island here. Many islands in the Gulf Stream in the intermediary area here, and on the opposing mainland over here. So that helps situate the language in the context of the other Waukesha languages. Here's a picture of the language tree. So this is a relatively small language family with a deep divide between the southern and northern branches. As you can see here, Kwakwala is one of the northern languages and is traditionally divided into five dialects, as you'll see here. This map gives a different perspective, showing the reserve territories of what are commonly referred to as the 17 tribes of the Kwakwaka'wakw peoples, dispersed along the coastal waters of Vancouver Island and throughout the smaller islands with the treacherous waterways there in the straits, and along the shores of the very deep inlets that cut into the opposing mainland. The population of approximately 7,500 people is dispersed not only across this diaspora of their traditional territory, but also due to decades of urban migration in major cities like Vancouver and Victoria. So the language is critically endangered. The 2010 report on the status of BC First Nations languages that was conducted by the First Peoples Heritage Language and Culture Foundation identifies it as almost extinct, with 148 fluent speakers in their survey. Now, this map is from the Umista Cultural Center from Alert Bay, and it shows the traditionally recognized division of the Kwakwala language into five major dialects. Note that the orange dialect grouping here is significantly bigger than the others, both in terms of subdivisions and in terms of the territory that it is dispersed over. And as we will see, it's also the one of the dialects within this territory is the one that has been most documented, and it's also the dialect with the most remaining fluent speakers, okay, which is significant in terms of trying to revitalize the other dialects within the territory. Significantly disadvantageous. So this research is funded in part by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. The project title was defined by the community. This is a very collaborative process with them. And what the project title, Let's Keep Our Language Alive, really focuses on is their goal is revitalization. And that the goal of this project is to provide a collaborative research and development context to mentor a very dedicated team of fluent elders to work with younger community members in a diversity of research and development projects that will enhance the transfer of language-based knowledge across the generations and will build a sustainable foundation for continuous Kwakwaka language transmission for generations to come. So their goal is revitalization. They recognize the serious importance of documentation, broad-based documentation for revitalization, and it's fundamentally collaborative in many respects. So a major challenge is the linguistic diversity within this territory. And that diversity is represented within the historical records of Kwakwaka. It's represented across the speech patterns of the extant speakers who are still with us. It's also represented across the generations, of course, even within a family. So the first question we wanted to ask is, what is the degree of documentation of the historical diversity? So what's on record as the historical situation? So traditionally, as we saw, Kwakwaka is characterized as having 5 dialects. They're listed here. You'll notice throughout the presentation there are a number of orthographies within the language. There are 2 orthographies which are most commonly in use right now. So the one on the left here is often referred to as the Umista orthography, developed through the Umista Cultural Center, and the one on the right here is a representation of that in a more North American phonetic alphabet, often called the Napa orthography. So these 2 columns actually are the same. These are the names of the dialects, and then this is the common English rendering of what those names refer to for the dialects. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's substantial documentation of Kwagyuk, which is one of the sub-dialects of Kwakwaka, and that's based on the extensive work that George Hunt, who was a speaker of that language, did over many decades of work with Boaz. There's serious under-documentation of all of the others. So here's a look at Kwakwaka, and we saw on the map of the family divisions earlier, these are the 5 dialect divisions of Kwakwaka. Here is each of these 5 dialects has its own internal subdivisions of languages. But what's important to note here, and it's just because of space for limitations that I haven't got the other ones on there, is that the Kwakwaka dialect has the most number of subdivisions there, and the greater amount of documentation available at a very early date was of this one dialect, the Kwagyuk, of this major dialect area. And so this led to the name Kwakwaka becoming the common term of reference for the whole language, which you see here. And that's not uncommon in some other groups. For example, Dakota comes to mind, where there are branches of Dakota, Nakota, Lakota, things like that. But this has not been a happy situation for the other members of this language grouping. So there's a pervasive awareness among the speakers of the different dialects that they do all speak the same language. There's some discontent, however, with the hegemony of the name of one dialect being foregrounded as representing the entire language group. And as a consequence, some people are proposing that Bakwan Kyala be put forward as a unified language name. So what we have here is Kwakwaka being the traditional name of the entire language. The Kwakwakiwak are the Kwakwaka-speaking peoples, but the issue is a desire for a name for the shared language that represents unity across the dialect diversity without foregrounding one language over the other. So Bakwam actually is the term which means a First Nations person. Bakun Kiala means literally to speak in the Indian way, the traditional way. First Nations is the nomenclature that we use in Canada to refer to the Aboriginal people of this territory, in distinction from the Inuit and the Métis as well. Okay. So the next question is, within the unity of one language, a major challenge for language revitalization initiatives is how to address dialect diversity. So very common issues that arise are issues of prescriptivism. So what's right? Because people want to learn what's right. They hear various things out there. There's not a lot of language around them in the community, so they want to know which is right. So, for example, very frequently you'll hear something like, my teacher says "tah" for black bear, but my auntie says "tla'i," which is right. There's a notion that there's some pure, unified language there. And, of course, the importance is that there's diversity. There's diversity in every language family and every language grouping, and so to begin to identify the diversity and understand the diversity and honor and respect the diversity that's there. Another issue is that there's a wonderful dictionary, for example, the Grubb Dictionary was done in 1977, and it's an extremely valuable resource, but it was based on work with a certain number of speakers from a limited dialect base. But very frequently, people will consult that dictionary appropriately for words, to find what the words are. So also, you don't have the full diversity represented in that one dictionary. We're working on a dictionary which incorporates much broader diversity. But at present, for example, you'll hear people say, but in the Grubb Dictionary, the word for deer is gewa. Why are you saying deer is takus? Okay. So then, the fact that it's in a book, there is this authority of its being in a legitimized printed source. And so that's something that is also important to realize, that there's diversity beyond what has been published. For small and often under-resourced endangered language communities, they often face a difficult choice, and that is, do they choose to standardize across the regional differences in terms of the curriculum development and revitalization materials, or do they choose to actively try to promote the revitalization of dialect diversity? The community's choice, actually, across the territory here, is that dialect diversity is the essence of identity. It's who you are and where you come from. So their choice is to represent dialect diversity, to research it, to document it, and to try and revitalize it. And so our basic goals are to show here that community involvement in language documentation and in linguistic analysis has tremendous value. Community engagement in learning about linguistic principles governing language diversity and diachronic historical change, and in conducting research to document and analyze dialect features, can contribute meaningfully to informing community-based discussion of educational policy choices. And that's what we've been working towards here. So with funding from the First Peoples Heritage Language and Culture Foundation, we've been working on the development of multi-dialectal booklets to go into the schools. And the goals here are to increase awareness within the school-age population as they're learning whatever language materials are being taught at their local level, that there are different ways of speaking, and that these can be referred to as dialects. They learn what their dialect is called, and what some of the other dialects, all of the other dialects are called, and what some of the differences are that would characterize one dialect from another dialect. So these differences are going to be at the level of sound. There are certain phonological differences. There are certain lexical differences. So there will be different words for deer, for example. And the hardest one, of course, to capture at this stage is grammatical differences between the dialects, but we're working towards that as well. So the dialects, of course, are situated in different parts of their traditional territories, so this provides an occasion to learn how language is in fact tied to land and to their territory. So an example of the dialogue would be in these little books, where are you from? Well, I'm from Guilford Island, I speak Kwakwala. I'm from Glendon Harbor, I speak Nakwala. So this is the kind of discourse which goes on in these. So in researching lexical differences, an excellent starting point was Liz Cadwallader's research project for our UBC First Nations Languages course. And Liz is here. There you are, Liz. Thank you. Okay, and what she did was she documented a number of differences between two of the dialects, Kwakwala and Nakwala, in what word was used, or differences in how a word was pronounced. And here's one of her beautiful slides. She did a lovely sequence of slides here, exemplifying the different word for deer in these two dialects. Okay. And what we'll do is we'll see a few of her things to give you a sense. Here we got a case where it's essentially the same word. You can see that it's the same word, but in the Nakwala dialect, you can see that there's an epithetic schwa in between the glottalized resonance and any subsequent sound, which is tautosyllabic. Here, what you can see is, again, a phonological difference, because these are etymologically the same word, but you can see that there's the diphthongization here has coalesced into a single vowel followed by a glottal stop up here. And this is the word for I. And again, you can see distinctions between the dialects in terms of the treatment of glottalized resonance and how they're manifest in the other dialects. And here is the word for earthquake. Okay, we were actually in Santa Barbara when we learned this word in the infamous summer of 2008, where all of a sudden happened with our Kwakwala class there. Okay, in the course of other documentation work with the language, we had discovered some other differences, which leads to a word of caution here. I had found the word for kasa, the word for otter, in some of the material, and I'd asked our consultant, Beverly Lagas, to pronounce it in the context of a class where we were working on differentiating uvulars from velars so that the students could actually get this distinction here. However, Beverly came out with a completely different word. So I, of course, thought, this is an interesting lexical difference, as you see here. So her word was Hwamdi, and this is Kasa, which I knew was from Alert Bay and Fort Rupert. However, it didn't take much more research to prove that this was wrong. So I'm just going to take you back to this map here. Kinkam Inlet, Waiyi, is located way up here, so 3.5-4 miles up the river from the end of Kinkam Inlet, which is here. This is Alert Bay down here. This is Port Hardy over here. So, okay. Turns out that Hwamdi is the term for land otter, okay, or inland otter, and Kasa is the word for sea otter. And the people who are on the coast, some of them know the words for both, but the people who live inland knew only the word for one of them. So, That was great to relate, of course, the words to the territory where they're located. Okay, so to find more potential cases of lexical difference, we've done two things further. We went through the Grubb Dictionary and I extracted all the words that he had tagged as being lexically distinct. And I'm now working with the Boaz manuscript of dictionary, which is unpublished but has a wealth of resources there, but they're from a long time ago, almost 100 years ago. And so it's very stimulating to try and re-elicit those forms, but a lot of those words just are not in the current lexical memory base. But we're working with it. So just a quick example here of some of the grammatical differences which we found. And the issue here is, in the context of language loss, it may be difficult to identify what was a dialect difference as opposed to what is due to language attrition. And this is a major challenge for us. So in going through my name is, okay, we were working, first of all, in the Alert Bay context, and we got this construction, Nugwa'am, Fiona Nugwa'am Pat, etc. All the way down, a list of some of our class members here. But then, in working with the Kingdom elder, we got a difference. Nuku Amphiona, Nuku Amphiona. Now, that little glottal stop at the end, first of all, you could miss it very easily and think that it was, you know, just the end of a sentence or breath coming out. However, you know, as we went down the list of things, we found that there is indeed a suffix on the end in this dialect. Okay, and it was very systematic, as you can see. A plain glottal stop after a name that ended in A, an A glottal stop after virtually any consonant, and a YA glottal stop after I. So you can postulate a base form of A glottal stop. There's a constraint against two vowels in sequence. If you have an AA vowel sequence, one of the A's deletes. If you have any other vowel, you'll get a homorganic glide in between. And so we have phonologically conditioned allomorphy here. The real question is, did the Alert Bay dialect never have this suffix, or did it lose this suffix through the process of language attrition, through loss? And then the question at the community level for them to decide is what should be taught in Alert Bay in the revitalization of their language. Okay. So, again, this is the phonological inventory of the language, and what we found in our research here is a very large inventory. A lot of these segments, of course, aren't in English, but we found that there are two particular contrasts that are subject to loss in the younger generations, and that is there's a systematic contrast between both plain and labialized velars as opposed to uvulars, and they're neutralizing in the direction of the velars over here. And the other distinction is this wonderfully rare class of glottalized resonants, which are neutralizing with the plain resonance here. So here's some examples, just the very name Quagute. What was written as a T here was actually a glottal stop. So the original thing had a glottal stop before a sh here, and that's being lost. Here's an example of the glottalized resonant in initial position, very hard for English ears to perceive, for example. But even glottalized resonance in medial position, where it's actually much easier to perceive, those are being lost. And here's an example of a neutralization to the velar position here. So the issue here is all languages, of course, change. And these changes are actually in the direction that markedness would predict. You know, they're losing the highly marked segments in the direction of the less marked segments. But the question is, what might or what should be the impact through endangered language revitalization initiatives of linguistically informed awareness of just what these changes are, where they're happening within the grammar? So that's, of course, a decision to be made at the community level, but the role of this kind of collaborative work is bringing those that kind of data to the awareness of the community. So I want to thank our collaborators again. The research team, you can see them all across the top of this slide. Funding agencies, the graphics from Doug Cranmer, and on the previous slide you saw the children from the school in Guayi, Kingdom Inlet. And here are some of the references. Thank you very much. Yes.